Welcome to the Ephesiology Podcast, in our series, Christ in Your Context, exploring why Jesus is good news where you are. Today we are with Michael, our resident ephesiologist. I'm Andrew Johnson in Houston, Texas, and we are thrilled to have Emmanuel Prince with us. Now, Emmanuel has earned a doctorate in intercultural leadership and is in the process of completing a PhD in international theological education. He has published three books on movements: Exponential Discipleship Making, Movement Catalysts, and the forthcoming, What Actually Starts Movements. And I'm already excited to ask you 1,000 questions about that. Emmanuel partnered with God to start a church planting movement among a Muslim people group in North Africa. That movement has grown to several hundred churches and far more than 10,000 disciples. These churches have multiplied up to the sixth generation. So Emmanuel, we are so excited to have you with us today on the Ephesiology Podcast.
I'm equally excited. Thank you so much for having me. I mean, obviously, both of you are sharp thinkers and bring a wealth of experience, ministry experience. So I expect that your question will make me sharper and your comments will make me wiser, too. So let's
learn from each other. That is a bar I don't know we can clear.
Well, you're very kind and gracious, Emmanuel. Well, I'm excited that you're on the podcast because Emmanuel is not only an author, a researcher, a scholar, but also a part of our Ephesiology Masterclasses team. He's on affiliate faculty at Kairos University and has developed and is in the process of developing a couple courses on movements in the Ephesiology Masterclasses catalog of courses. And I'm very excited about this. And very excited that you will, Lord willing, have an opportunity to mentor students in this whole area of movements and movemental thinking and dynamics and what it means to be a catalyst and a leader who God uses to spawn a movement. So looking forward to partnering with you, Emmanuel.
Same here, Michael. I find the Ephesiology Masterclass is extremely valuable. You've done great pioneer work, and to be a part of that is a privilege. I feel a little, you know, after you're heaping these accolades of praise onto me, I want to say one thing, though.
You can say a few things.
I wake up in the morning, and really, I am the Father's beloved, and that matters at the end of the day. I feel everything that you have kind of highlighted flows out of this. And so let's, as the children of God, have an exciting conversation here.
Well, I would say that's, we can close on the podcast on that, because that's actually all that matters, is that joy of who and whose we are. So thank you for that reminder, because like you said, that's the truth at the beginning of the day, and that's the truth at the end of the day, no matter what happens. Emmanuel, what are some things that you might share to kind of color in the edges? So again, you are not just your accolades. What are a few things maybe your friends or family might know about you that you would be willing to share on a podcast so we can get to know you a bit better?
Okay. Well, one of them is, I put it this way. You either get me full power or power off. What that means is people would describe me certainly as a hard worker, but I have learned to just switch off and live the rhythm of, you know, 6 days of work, but also one day of Sabbath rest, of doing nothing, of just enjoying God's goodness. So that would be one thing that probably people say I kind of live to an extreme. I'm a lover of football. And with football, I mean, not what you Americans call football, which is kind of very strange. You call a sport football where you're not allowed to kick the ball with the football.
Yes.
I mean, soccer.
Exactly.
So like watching it, supporting my home team in Germany, and also playing it both with my son and then occasionally with friends. And that's a great way to relax and have fun.
Who is your team?
Cologne. I guess no one on your podcast will ever heard of it. It's not a team that wins title all the time. It's a team that you cry with and mourn with. But yeah, I mean, 40 years of loyal supportership, or 35 probably. Yeah. Another one is people describe me as a radical learner. I just love learning. You know, I've always a pile of books that I read parallel that are on my not any longer on my bedside table. My wife said she doesn't like that. They have to stay in the office room.
Yeah.
But on the living room table as well. And I don't know. I think it is something that God somehow built into me and wired me into. And I do believe we will spend, in a way, all eternity learning. Yes. And probably less problem solving. Much of our learning today is to solve issues and problems. That will be less the case in heaven. But I mean, really learning about, obviously, God's greatness, God's character, and his values, and his way of thinking, and then in a way governing the new world. So I believe that will carry over really for the rest of our lives, not only on this earth, but beyond. So three things that I think most of my friends would say stand out about me.
That's incredible. Well, then let me launch on into this continued learning. You have been a part of movements. So before we get to asking the question that your forthcoming book, What Actually Starts Movements, will come out and kind of touch on, what are some of the things that you have seen God do in the movements that you've been a part of?
Wow. I have seen that, let's call it, for simplicity's sake, rebel army commanders who were 50 meters away from meetings of an early pre-movement stage where gatherings were taking place, where people were listening to Bible stories and then engaging in dialogue about some very basic discovery questions. So these guys were 50 meters away under a different tree while we are sitting in the shade, you know, blazing Sahara sun of a tree just 50 meters away. And they were there to obviously control what was happening and reporting it up the chain, and how they drew closer and eventually came in. To the point that they were still wearing their Kalashnikovs or AK-47s, we said, look, we love to have you welcome, but please would you kindly leave your weapons outside. And then seeing that these guys took slow, careful, but deliberate steps of faith and eventually became promoters of the faith. I mean, this is before all of this started, I was dreaming in my wildest dreams. The imam, which is the religious leader of a local mosque, of a local congregation, the same, coming and then starting to talk about Isa al-Masih, about Jesus the Messiah, in his sermons in the mosque for a while, and then at some point he publicly confessing that he had become a follower of Jesus Christ himself. So these are just some highlights. The background is, why I'm sharing this, we believed in starting a movement, we needed to focus on opinion leaders, on influencers in society, the gatekeepers, the authority figures. So we deliberately reached out to them and we deliberately pray for them, but it's still, when you see it happen, it's kind of, really, is this really happening? So these are two images, two highlights that spontaneously come to mind.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, you tell a little bit of your story in your forthcoming book, What Starts Movements. Take us through that. How did you get involved in this? What was it that drew you to the Lord? And how did he then begin to shape you and give you a heart to follow hard after him?
I grew up in a fundamentalist Christian home and had a you know, faith crisis sort of when I did my major in biology and what we in Europe call A-levels, high school. And, you know, evolution and my agnostic or atheistic friends and classmates challenged me. And so I initially had a strictly intellectual conversion. So, you know, I read Josh McDowell's and the other works on the credibility of the Bible and evidence for the resurrection. And that convinced me that there must be a God. And it convinced me that if there is a God, it is certainly the God of the Bible. These are just milestones. So I soon committed not only to the Lord, but also wanted to serve him at the ends of the earth. I went to seminary, and in my first semester in the introduction to missiology, our professor devoted one lecture to people movements. I'd never heard of it before. I'd never heard a missionary talk about it. Completely new concept. But I was instantly fascinated and totally intrigued. And I thought, why am I only hearing this now? Why is not everyone talking about this? So here the radical learner surfaces. I figured out there's a university in Germany that was about like 150 kilometers away from where I studied, or probably a little more even. And I went to that library. I knew that library had the mandate to have every English speaking book that has ever been published in theology. Mm. And so I found half a dozen of books with the title movements, or movements being part of the title. I photocopied them page by page and went home and read them, honestly. And that was what equipped me for movement ministry. So this is before David Garrison's church planting movements, even the booklet came out in 99, before we talked about Discovery Bible Study or anything like that. But it equipped me, it informed my ministry strategy for on the ground to think, how can we think multi-individual conversion? That is a key concept I took away. Mm-hmm. And how can we think movement from the first day rather than, and especially in Muslim ministry, that was still the predominant practice, extraction of individual converts and then adding them to our group. So with the team, we prayed from the first day, 100% Muslim people group, no non-believers at all. We started from the first day praying and then strategizing, how can we reach the whole society? How can we create a chain reaction here?
Let me jump in only for a definition. I think you've hit the edge of it, but just so we can get multi-individual conversion. What do you mean by that? If people are not familiar with some of the movemental lexicon.
Yeah. Well, most of the world live in communal societies, and that means they make decisions in communities. And so if we have Westerners come and ask Ahmed, you know, make a commitment to follow the Lord Jesus, that is not how they make the rest of the decisions that they make in life. They go back and consult and ask their father for permission. They talk it over with their brothers, or maybe even a wider community. And so if we do that individual conversion as we know it, then instantly that breaks the social bonds and also in many times robs them of the opportunity to become a credible witness of Jesus. So multi-individual, that's a term from McGavran, emphasizes it is still an individual decision,
right?
But it's done in community. It's not done in isolation. And so to give you a picture of this, when we felt the first group was ready to enter the kingdom, to make a confession that they want to follow the Lord Jesus and renounce Satan and all his work. That was basically the essence of conversion, how we articulated it. We didn't call those where it was clear and evident that they were ready to follow Jesus right now. We didn't call them to make a step, but we waited until the rest of the group was ready, and we felt they together as a group would now ready to make that commitment. And they did it publicly. So small village, you know, in Africa, you can picture that we're sitting under the tree and the background is the village school. And then curious women and children and others are in the background, curious what's happening, why our village chiefs and elders sitting together and having these conversations with the white man and some other people from outside. And so publicly, you know, they stand up and pray a prayer of commitment. That is an expression of multi-individual conversion.
Yeah, you know what? You're hitting on some things that seem to me to be fundamentally important in our theology that we seem to miss. And I think it's probably due to a Western individualistic understanding of what conversion is, that it happens to an individual. It's one by one. We're solely responsible. It's that hyper-individualism that we are so familiar with in the Western context. But what you're talking about here is something that, and plus, you know, we want it instantly, don't we?
I want it yesterday.
Rapid expansion. Yeah.
Accept Jesus as your personal Lord and Savior. Yeah, that captures it so well, doesn't it?
Yeah. The sinner's prayer.
Yeah. So, but what you're saying here, Emmanuel, is I'm hearing two things. One is that this is not necessarily a rapid process. It takes time, but once it happens, because the second point, you're focusing on the thought leaders, the key leaders in a community, then it seems to me it is where you get into an expansive multiplication of a movement that is more rapid than the beginning process. Am I reading this accurately?
No, you're spot on, Michael. And when I years later heard David Watson say, in movements, go slow to go fast, I thought, that's it. That's right. What we did. I wouldn't have been able to, you know, capture it so succinctly. But yes, that's what we did. Rather go slow and make sure the unity of the group that is slowly journeying closer to Jesus is preserved, because if it is, it will take more time, as you observe, Michael. It does. It's a conversion process rather than a step. However, once it happens, if the community and the unity is preserved, you have the church. There is no fracture. There is no, you know, disruption in the process. So a slow process, an organic process, but once it's reached, you have critical mass in that village.
You know what? This is so important, Emmanuel, as you know, of course. I mean, you're the guy that's doing all the research on this. But you are very aware that some of the criticism, harsh criticism, about disciple-making movements and church-planting movements is the emphasis on the rapid expansion of the gospel and rapid multiplication. But what you're saying is, in the movements that you've studied, and if I recall, you've studied 147 movements around the world, that does not seem to be the primary first characteristic, but rather what you're talking about is the slow communal cohesion, where in a community of leaders initially, and then expanding on to other people, that there's a community, a socialization, if you will, to an understanding of who Christ is. And then when that happens, there's expansion.
Yeah. I think there is a both and here. Rapid multiplication, rapid expansion. It is rapid at times in movements, or usually it is, if you look at it from a distance. So if you kind of zoomed out on what is happening in our movement, the movement that we partnered with God to start, you know, it was initially in one village, but boom, it took very little time. And three village chiefs said, we want the same in our village. Boom, we were in five villages. And then others came and boom, we were in 10 villages. So from that distance, there is a kind of rapid spread. But when you're in it, you're right. Then it actually looks slow.
You know, it's fascinating, Emmanuel, as I'm listening to you. We started by saying, you know, who is Christ in your context? Why is he good news? And I know it sounds silly and it seems even basic, but operating like this forces us to see Jesus as faithful, because we have to place our trust that he is going to do the thing that we are unable to do, right? That slow process means we are constantly saying, we trust you, Jesus, and we trust that you're going to come through. But the other way that I see Christ coming out even clearly is we see him as patient too, that he is not the God who rushes, that he is not the God who must have a decision. Well, I mean, he does ask us to make a decision. So again, I understand we're kind of walking this tightrope, but he's patient with us, and he is patient to let us bring the good news of him to people. And he is patient with them as they continue to talk about it and think about it and discuss it with one another, so that, like you said, it's not one by one, but it looks like community by community, and his faithfulness comes through. And so we see both Jesus as patient and faithful. I don't know. These are aspects about God that I feel coming out as we're discussing this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it has a profound impact to look at Christ and his patience with individuals and community. It should have a profound impact on us as practitioners. Whether there are setbacks due to external factors, like, you know, we were in a civil war context, sometimes for months we couldn't even access the areas due to fighting. Others experience setbacks in terms of there is no spiritual progress, or after some progress we're experiencing now a ministry setback. So what does patience look like? Patience, in my experience, is not passivity to say, okay, that's how it is. No, patience was to me to think, I don't need to push anything. We do have the long-term vision, and it may take, we have no guarantee, it may take 20 years. And frankly, that's how I started out. I thought, you know, we're going to be here for 20 years. We're going to be, as you said, demonstrate Christ. How did you say it? You put it so well. Not the felt needs, but...
Oh, I can't even remember what good I said.
Well, Christ is the answer to basically their felt needs. You use different words, but that's what you said. Yeah. So we want to demonstrate that and serve the community in practical ways, meeting their felt needs. So that way we demonstrate the love of Christ. We demonstrate that in the way we relate to them. We love and treasure every person we meet and convey the love of God to them. And we do that every day. I thought we would do that for 20 years. I mean, this is hardened society, right? Very anti-Christian. It would take us 20 years, but I had always the belief one day we would see movement breakthrough. So that patience is a sort of, as long as we hold steady, we constantly evaluate, are we still on the right track? Are we making any progress? What is making the progress? Where are hindrances that we need to address? It may take 20 years, but every day brings me one day closer to that long-term vision. That is how I experienced what you describe here as a patience.
Wow, that's good. This is good. Well, I am so excited about your class that you've developed, and I'm going to take it, I think, at least sit in on it to learn some more. But okay, so here's a question I'm going to throw out to you. I have no idea how you're going to answer it, but I'm super curious, because you are currently completing your PhD on international theological education, or that's the focus of the PhD. Where do you see this intersecting? Where does theological education intersect with movement dynamics?
In several ways. I will just mention those that come to my mind most immediately. I told you that we used a storytelling approach. Well, a theologian, someone who has been trained in the Bible theologically, is the person who can select what are the stories that are most essential to conveying the message we want to convey? And what are the stories that will relate to their worldview, at the same time challenge and expand their worldview? So my theological degree helped me greatly to determine among all the Old Testament stories we could tell them, which are the ones that we could select. Mm-hmm. A second aspect is a discovery approach. To me, the discovery approach does mean at the basic disciple-making level to always ask the same questions. You know, what do we learn about God? What do we learn about people? How can where's an example that we can, a positive one that we can follow, a negative one we can avoid? How can we follow this? But I think discovery to me cannot remain as simplistic. When disciples grow and when you come to leadership development, I believe the task of a trained theologian is to develop Bible study manuals. Let's call it like that. Sets of Bible stories combined with intelligent discovery questions. What theologians would call inductive Bible study questions, right? So what are the questions we want them to engage with? What are the questions we want them to ask to the Bible as they discover together? Here, I believe the work of a theologian is essential. Then the whole contextualization issue. My point of view is the outside catalyst shouldn't deliver all the answers. It should be the local leaders who determine how do we incarnate our newfound faith, our discipleship in our societal context. But, well, even if I say go to the Bible and see what it says, they have just started reading the Bible. I can say, you know, go to Acts 15. Go to these passages in 2 Corinthians where Paul talks about incarnational ministry. So again, that doesn't require to have a PhD in theology, but it requires some level of theological education. So I think then a theologian can steward his gifting and their educational expertise that they have gained in the equipping process of local disciples and then of local leaders.
This is fascinating. Okay, yeah. So here is my question then for the both trained theologian and the theologian in training, because you are both. What are some of the stories that you think, you know, you don't have to go into all the stories, but what are aspects of who Jesus is that you have found works well in that African setting that you were? What did they need to hear about Jesus? And how was that different from what Germans needed to hear about Jesus? And how are you seeing that's different from the context where you're in now?
Right. Okay. So I'll start with the African rural context. Jesus is the one who heals. Jesus is the one, and I should say forgive first, but there is no particular order. He's the one who heals, who forgives, and who delivers. These were the three core authorities of Jesus that we emphasize in selecting stories about them. And I want to add a fourth one that we realized only on the go.
Yeah.
Is the value, how does Jesus value and affirm the dignity of women?
That's right? A very important one.
And that is a very important one, and we found that was appealing to the women themselves. Obviously, no movement if it's only men, but that was the one that brought societal change. Suddenly, marriages change. I mean, not suddenly, over time, marriages change. Women had a different standing in society, and those Christian marriages of Jesus followers that were changed, that was obvious because everyone lives in community, others noticed the changes. And then again, became appealing to others to, wow, you know, that is a positive change. That is a change that we actually also want. So that is a fourth one we basically discovered on the way. Jesus heals, Jesus delivers, Jesus forgives. That was the center. Is it different from a society in the States or Germany? I think right now, wherever I witness, I emphasize more than I have those really on the love of Jesus. Jesus, the one who is fond of you, likes you, has affections for you, just the way you are. You don't need to renovate yourself first. You come to him as you are. Just start talking to him. He will listen to you. So obviously, the areas of healing and the liberation, and with that I mean things like, you know, bondages, curses, anything demonic is not visible. I mean, for health issues, we go to the pharmacy or to the doctor. So remains forgiveness. But as you also know, forgiveness is not a felt need of most modern people in our societies. So what is a felt need? I think people, in my experience, have psychological needs. You know, what's my value? I work as hard as I can. I get the next promotion. I get the next pay raise. But I still don't feel my value. What's the point of life anyway? What's the mean? What gives me meaning? So that would right now be more the focus in my personal sharing, as well as when I train others in how to evangelize in individualistic Western societies.
Yeah,
Does that answer your question?
Absolutely.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, what you're talking about is something that I've kind of latched onto in some of the research that we're doing in Asia Minor, and that's looking for what Colin Himmer talked about as polemical parallels. Mm-hmm. Where is Jesus a polemical parallel to a culture? And so, if there's an issue in the culture that there's a need for healing, and they're going to, you know, whoever it would be, witch doctor, you know, some healer in their society, in their community, then the polemical parallel there is that Jesus is the healer. He's the true healer, and so on. And so the same with love. If we're searching for love in, you know, as the old country Western song said, in all the wrong places, then... Jesus as a polemical parallel to that is that he is love and so on. So I love what you're talking about there, Emmanuel.
Mm. I hadn't heard the concept, but we're probably talking about the same thing. I usually describe it as felt needs. Everyone has needs, and people are aware of some of them and unaware of others. For example, every modern heathen in my country has a need for forgiveness. But it's not a felt need. Right. So appealing to that felt need has very limited impact. So therefore, the incarnation of Christ's love, I believe, is to understand what are their felt needs, what are their holes in their heart, right, that are not filled by their lifestyle without Jesus, and how could Jesus be the answer to that?
Yeah, that's good. Good.
Do you feel... as you continue to observe and process, that mindset of the multi-individual conversion, do you feel or have you seen the success of that in highly individualistic contexts?
Less so than in an African village, but also, so in our immediate context here in town, for example, a whole family was baptized just a few months ago. And how did they, for total heathens, you know, God, church, nothing in their lives. But there were personal issues to do with economic strains, and the church was able to help. you know, through a debt recovery program. And initially the mother, and then her almost, well, adult children just living still at home, all three of them at about the same time decided that faith was real and they wanted to follow Jesus. So imagine a mother of like 45 and two 20, 22-year-old still living at home. Definitely individuals, grown-ups,
right.
But together they journeyed closer to Christ and have become disciples. So it does happen, not as frequently, but it is possible. I think, again, it needs to be encouraged. I don't know your context, but the traditional idea is, of course, we lead people to Christ. And once we have told them, once they have made a commitment, we tell them, you know, it's about reading the Bible, about praying, about belonging to a church, and about sharing your faith. But encourage them to share what they're discovering even before they make that commitment has the potential at least to bring others along in the journey even before they actually become Christians.
Wow, that's great. Emmanuel, tell us about the courses that you've developed, two of them, Movement Essentials and Becoming a Catalyst, as well as What Starts Movements.
Okay, a summary. So the first one, Movement Essentials, and Becoming a Catalyst. It's important to me, and I think it's important for the credibility of movements, that we strongly base what we do on the Bible. So the one goal of this course is to look at some leading movement authors and publications and find what they promote in the Bible, in the New Testament. That's one. And I think that will strengthen convictions of students who take the course and ground their own beliefs directly in the Bible and just not in the, you know, success stories or articles or books of a certain other author. The second aspect, becoming a catalyst, that's something I'm, as you both, well, you, Michael, know that, very passionate about. And that's the question, you know, who can start a movement? Can I? What is in my hands and what is in God's hands? What is my job and what is God's job? And to sum it up, we cannot manufacture a movement. Absolutely not. However, what I believe we have full control over is our personal growth. And to give away, you know, a key piece of the courses, and that's what my research has found, is God uses different methodologies to start movements. And the research is clear about this. DMM is used widely, but then there are others. There's T4T, there is Four Fields, and various others. So a variety of methods. But wherever you see a movement, Michael, you find a certain catalyst, a man or woman who has certain traits and competencies in common with the other catalysts. So if we sat down in a coffee shop in Houston, Andrew, or wherever, you know, and there was a catalyst from the States and another one from rural Kenya or Sudan, another one from a metropolis in India, and let's say myself, we would all be unique individuals with our idiosyncrasies and our cultural distinctives, but we all have certain qualities in common. I call these the catalytic qualities, and that's what the book is about and what the course is about. And the great news is that these catalytic qualities can be developed to a very large extent. So wherever you see a movement, you will find a certain person. So if this is the kind of person God uses to start movements, then I say, well, I want to grow as much as is in my hands to become that person, to develop these character traits, to acquire the necessary skills and competencies. And they can be developed, they can be acquired. And this is what the second part of the course, Movement Essentials and Becoming a Catalyst, is about.
Yeah, great. And then you're going to unpack a lot of this in terms of the second course, what starts a movement, where you're going to get into more detail about the catalyst and the different movements that you've researched. Tell us a little bit about that course.
Sure. So I guess I should say this. This is coming out of solid research, as you said. With my team, I have researched 147 different movements worldwide in 29 different countries, in among at least 102 different people groups, and in every of the six megacultures of the world. We have also studied 160 control groups, and that is ministries that did ministry in either the very same context where the movement occurred, or a very similar context, so we can compare what distinguishes the two. So I want to say this at the same time, on my heart is to equip practitioners. So for those who think like research, oh, that sounds like dry and library and boring. No, I leave aside the technical stuff and all of that and just focus on the findings that have immediate relevance for ministry praxis, on actionable, you know, insights. Mm-hmm. In addition, the other course focuses on not only the person of the catalyst, but also the research identified 11 movement boosters, that's how we call them, and 10 movement blockers. So this is not my personal opinion or our experience in North Africa. This is from those 147 effective catalysts who started a movement. And we invited them to assess how much has each of these factors contributed to the catalyzing of your movement, or to what extent have these factors hindered more growth, more ministry fruitfulness, and more growth. And so what the course is then about is to learn, well, to understand what these factors are, to discover them, and then to learn to assess them in our present ministry situation, which may not be movement at all, which may be pre-movement stage, early multiplication, and then to learn how to instill them more, strengthen the boosters, and to identify the blockers and say, how can we either overcome them, do away with them, or at least, if that's not possible, mitigate them.
Yeah, wow, that's great. Now, you had something like 32,000 data points.
Yes.
Is that right?
That's
so
right.
This is solid research. I love the fact that you are doing a comparative analysis of movements and non-movements. And so this is going to be potentially very impactful. So I'm grateful, Emmanuel, that you've developed these courses, that we're partnering with you to deliver them. And I want to encourage our listeners, if this is appealing to you, you need to take Emmanuel's course. He would love to walk alongside of you in a journey to seeing movements catalyzed around the world.
Yep. And Michael, you may want to mention this, or I'll mention it for you now. We said the first round we will make this a live course. So that means for everyone joining, there will be the live interaction in a Zoom call, so you can bring your questions, your issues, what you wrestle with, and then we will have engaging peer-to-peer conversations. And obviously, I will also be there and maybe answer a question or two.
This is great. When is it going to be live? Well, like when? I mean, obviously, we at a Physiology Masterclasses will have this up soon when it's ready. When is that?
We are still working on the date.
Okay. There's nothing like a pregnant pause, right? We'll just wait on it, wait on it. So if you have been excited by what you've heard today, go to masterclasses.aphysiology.com and check weekly just to see if this is the week that this course that you have been so excited to take with Emmanuel Prince is going to be available, right? So Emmanuel, if people are excited by what they are hearing, how can they keep up with you or the work that you are doing?
I write a regular blog that is available at the moment, still free of charge. So if you're interested in that, and I trust Andrew, we can post the link as well. The website is catalyticleadership.info, www.catalyticleadership.info. And I invite you to subscribe to it. And I always feature updates from the latest research that I'm working on. That is certainly a key way to stay in touch. The book will come out on May 28th that you referenced. What actually starts movement? Partnering with God for Kingdom Multiplication. That's based on the latest research that we discussed here. And then my previous book, Movement Catalyst, you'll find that on Amazon in your country, wherever you are.
This is great. Well, Emmanuel, thank you so much for being our guest. And certainly, listeners, thank you so much for joining us in this exciting conversation. We here at Ephesiology want to make sure to continue to point towards Jesus, be driven by Christ, and partner with him in the movements that he is doing across the world. So if you haven't listened to all 200 plus of our episodes, please, there's a big back catalog. We invite you to listen in. And then, as I noted, go to masterclasses.ephesiology.com to see how theological education might be right for you in your context. So from Michael, Emmanuel, and myself, thank you for doing theology and community with us today on the Ephesiology Podcast.